Hello again and welcome to another episode of Quick Question with Soren and Daniel, the only comedy, writing, and friendship podcast hosted by two television asterisk writers. I think I have not checked. I am one half of this podcast, staff writer for Last Week Tonight with John Oliver, and person who in a freshman year production of West Side Story was voted by his female castmates to be most adorable, which is the kindest but still most hurtful way you can declare a guy the least fuckable. And I am joined, as always, by my co-host, Mr. Soren Bowie. Soren, say hello.
Hi, I'm Soren Bowie. I am a writer for American Dad. My title is Executive Story Editor. Thank you very much. And I was once on a Rafta bus in my hometown, and a man there said, "Hey, a pretty girl like you shouldn't be wearing a hat. You almost look like a boy."
Okay. So one thing, executive story editor, is that new? Did I miss that?
No. You said staff writer, and I was like, wow, he's been at that job for a while. He'll still be a staff writer.
But you're executive story editor?
Yeah. So the way
that's exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And now the other thing. So you're traveling and a stranger yelled at you?
This was when I was a kid. I was back when I was probably about the same age as you were getting labeled most adorable. I was also a late bloomer sitting on what we called, it was called Rafta bus. It was like the Roaring Fork public transit system. And there was just the river that ran from Aspen all the way down through Glenwood Springs, this like Aspen Valley. And I was traveling on it once and this man was staring at me. And I used to wear a Minnesota Twins hat all the time. I was a big Kirby Puckett fan.
And like most girls.
And this guy kept looking at me and I was like, this is weird. And then he decided to speak up and he said, I think he was just trying to decide. He was like, is that a boy or a girl? I've made up my mind. I got to speak on this. And he said, hey, a pretty girl like you shouldn't be wearing a hat. You almost look like a boy.
Huh. Yeah. That's, I wish I could reach that man now who is surely dead. So I could just let him know you don't need to speak up. If your conflicting thoughts are, is this a boy or is this a girl? I know I need to say something.
Right.
Well, it's like, what angle do I want to take? I would like to time travel to that guy and be like, hey man, sit this one out. Ride the pine for a while.
You'd think so. And then I like thought back to it and I was like, that's the same era as Pat was really successful on Saturday Night Live, where people were like, fuck, I don't know what gender that thing is. I gotta know.
Right.
Like it really mattered to them to find out what gender Pat was.
Right. Like if you'd said, excuse me, sir, I am a boy. He'd be like, oh, okay. I can sleep tonight then. I can go home and I can put this mystery to bed.
Yeah, he would have felt a lot better. And you know what? You're right. He probably is dead because he didn't look like the healthiest of gentlemen. He was a little heavy set and he was had one of those gin blossoms. And he was riding the public transit as like a 40-year-old. So I think that's a pretty clear DUI story.
I'm sorry, gin blossoms?
A gin blossom. Yeah, that's when your nose is really red and it's kind of swollen from...
From drinking?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Okay, got it.
I see where you're confused. Also the popular era for the gin blossoms.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he had one of them just on his lap.
Right. Right. He was just sitting with one of the gin blossoms and he saw your youth and your ambiguity. And he was like, hey, jealousy. Because he wanted that, you know?
Yeah, of course.
So this is our podcast where we are incredibly inessential, especially in these times during quarantine and during these important protests that we will not touch on because our voices seem not important at this moment. But we're still going to do our silly bullshit, if that is helpful to anyone. And by anyone, I mean our listeners who prefer to be called Quizzo and Quinicky, close friends of Danny Zuko Bryant and Surendra Bodhi.
I enjoyed that one with relish.
Did you?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's a line from it, from old Greece, where she says, Kinnicky says, hey, bite the weenie, Riz. And she says, with relish. And it's a really clever line in the middle of Greece.
Is there, can I ask you, since you're our resident Greece expert,
yeah.
Was there a better way to insert your name into this?
Do it again.
Quizzo and Quinicky, close friends of Danny Zuko Bryant and Surendra Bodhi.
Um, No, I mean, John Travolta doesn't really lend itself to it, does it? I'd have to like go through the cast names and be like, well, what were their actual, like, what were the names of the characters? Maybe that would help.
Stocker Channing, Olivia Newton-John, John Travolta, yeah. Jeff Conway, Didi Khan.
There's not a lot of options.
I mean, that's more than someone should know without Googling.
That's true. In fact, you should be now crowned the resident expert.
Oh, no.
And I mean, honestly, if I was going down that same road as you, I saw that none of them worked for my name. I would have been like, well, that road leads nowhere. I won't use that one.
Okay.
But you forged on.
I did. I really tried to make Sandra D into Sorendra Boody.
It worked.
I'm not positive it did.
Thanks to Skillshare for supporting Quick Question. Break up the routine of a day spent indoors. Explore workshops, classes, and more in topics like photography. Get 2 free months of premium membership at Skillshare.com/QQ.
But let's get into the show where we ask each other questions and we try to get some answers. And I have a couple for you this week, if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely.
One of them, so we're skipping our coronavirus quarantine check-in this week.
Because it's over.
Because it doesn't matter. Because my main quick question for you, Soren. Hey, quick question.
Shoot.
What do you think you would be doing if this quarantine pandemic coronavirus thing happened when you were in high school?
Yeah. Okay.
And like, I think we can talk about this in one of two ways, whichever you prefer. Like, you're in high school now in 2020,
yeah.
Or this happens when you were in high school, whatever year that was.
I think it maybe doesn't matter. My answer isn't going to paint me in a very good light. I would have been breaking quarantine constantly. I would
really?
Have been off with my friends or trying to... Like, I would have had a very romantic idea. If I had a girlfriend then, I would have probably had a very romantic idea of like how we were breaking it to be together. It, where I was like writing the story of my life as I was doing it and being like, this will be a good chapter. but yeah, I think that I see kids at the park who are like 14, 15, and I see them together and I'm so mad at them. And then I think, mm-hmm. you know, I would have been doing the exact same thing. I wouldn't have cared.
Really?
Yeah. My selfishness would have outweighed any sort of fear that I would have been hurting families or the elderly. I would have treated it like, look, maybe I'll catch this thing. Maybe I won't. And it's not worth me losing this time with the people that I like.
Yeah. Now, do you think that's has more to do with your character or more to do with the fact that when you were in high school, you were like secluded in the woods in a high school of like 13 people?
Yeah. Probably the latter. It was like in high school, I felt this desperate need to, that I was going to miss out on anything. And like that life was very, very short. And that if people were having experiences without me, that was deeply depressing to me. Like I needed to be there for the things. And if I missed them, it was like, well, then the game over. Like I missed it. We might as well just end it right now. And I think that maybe that's also like the brain chemistry of a kid in high school, that there's, how your relationship to your peers is so much more valuable than anything else in your life at that point, which is why young boys do like crazy shit and very dangerous stuff, because even their own life means less than the approval of their peers. And then you kind of, I think your brain slowly grows out of that as you get older. You can't blame those kids for that. That's just like, the priorities are different in that brain chemistry. And I think that would have been super important to me to be with people. We've been having bonfires out in the woods or on people's properties out on like farms so that we could be together and police couldn't break it up.
Okay. Well, I think we had different experiences because I've been thinking about this for a while because I this has come up on the podcast a few times, the amount of people I see not wearing masks in New York City right now. And there are a lot of youths in the park and some of them seem like they're like loudly violating the rules.
Yeah.
Where like they want to be counter and I don't want to, I'm trying to figure out if I'm mad at them or not, or if like, if that's who I would be if this hit me when I was in high school. And like not to to really dial into what a square I am, but I think I would follow all the rules. And I think like my closest test case for me, my case study rather, was 9/11, which did hit when I was in high school. And for a lot of like naive young people, that was the first exposure to the idea that history could still happen. Because you like, if it like an end of an innocence for a generation of kids kind of thing. It's a very sheltered position to have, but I can remember walking around in 2000 period and thinking like, well, everything that's happened is going to happen. We're not going to have anything new. And if we have something new, we're going to be able to take care of it. And then 9/11 happened and it was like, we're going to need to print new history books now. I thought we were done.
Right.
I thought that was it. And our reaction to 9/11 growing up in New Jersey was like, a swell of community that probably erred on the side of like maybe too much patriotism, but still we didn't think of it in like a jingoistic patriotism sort of way. We just thought of it like a community, like, oh, we're all together now. And like, it was the most American I'd felt at that point in my life. Cause I was just like, I'd felt New Jerseyan for 15 years. And suddenly it was like, oh no, I'm part of this much larger thing. And we all take this very seriously. And we're all we're upset about it together. And we're angry about it together. And there were certainly people in my high school who were either in the spirit of being counterculture or were very informed people, were saying like, this never would have happened if America didn't something, something. Daniel didn't pay attention enough in history class to know why other countries would be mad at us. But I was certainly on the side of like, no, let's all band together and like rise up and be a community and a force here, which makes me think I would do whatever my government told me to do in the coronavirus.
I get that. Like the idea, it's very easy to get swept up in the idea that everyone's on the same team when something big happens, especially when you're young, because you've never seen it before. All you see is a lot of divisiveness. And then all of a sudden there's like some cause that every single person can rally behind. And it feels very good to be on the big team. Right. At that age. So yeah, I get that. I get why.
Right. Because at like fucking 15 years old in 2000, when it's like, I like Nintendo 64, fuck you, I like PlayStation. And it's like, I kind of like both of them, but I understand that I need to pick a side. And then there's like a much larger problem that casts a large shadow over the smaller problems that you'd understood as divisions. It's like, oh, okay. Now I get it. Yeah. Now I understand like actual team tribal mentality.
Yes. It's interesting to me that experience changed you the way that it did. I always sort of wanted something like that when I was young. And don't want to say like catastrophic like 9/11. I don't always want a 9/11 is what I'm saying.
No.
I wanted something that I thought, this changed me, or this changed the way that I see the world. And none of it really did. Even like I was in high school when Columbine happened, and everybody was talking about it. People were crying because it wasn't so far from where we were. Mm-hmm. And it didn't change it. Like in my mind, like I didn't feel older. I didn't feel any different. It still felt removed from me. It still felt like the sun was still shining. It was still a good afternoon. And like, I wanted to go do the things that I would do anyway. And in my mind, I'm selfishly thinking, well, is this going to stop us from playing Ultimate Frisbee like we usually do at 6 o'clock every day? Like that kind of thing.
Yeah. And I don't want to overplay what happened to me. Like if you ask my family, they won't say like on September 10th, he was one day. And then on September 12th, he was, you know, watching the news and he was suddenly like tapped in and lost all sense of humor or anything like that. I was still a fucking piece of shit kid, but, again, the best way I can describe it is like history is still happening, which was certainly what 9/11 was. I guess you were you in college for 9/11?
Yeah, I remember. Yeah, I had a roommate we had lived in a quad, and I had a roommate, Sam Bergen, who came and knocked on our door and said, "We're under attack. Every city's being bombed."
God almighty.
We went, what? And then we came out and watched the TV. We saw what was happening. And a lot of us didn't, same way as you, like, we didn't understand. Well, why would anyone attack us?
Yeah.
Like, we didn't get it. And and then you kind of learn those things along the way because you have to learn them quick.
Yeah. They made an announcement in, I think it was my second period class, chemistry, forgive me, AP chemistry. And the principal came on the loudspeaker and was like, "At this time, this day, a plane crashed into this tower." And we were like, "Oh shit." And then the message continued. And then she's like, "And then another plane crashed into the other tower." Oh. And we all looked at each other like, "Man, well, that's some bad luck," because no one had any idea what was going on.
Right.
We the idea of terrorist attack didn't like factor into anyone's thought process. It was just like, "What the fuck is going on with planes today? Am I right? All right, back to chemistry."
Right. And I mean, I do remember that feeling of, you see it, that a plane crashed into a building, and you're like, "Oof, what went wrong there?" And you're kind of like thinking about it. And then when you see the other one hit, that's the first time it really registers that this is intentional. And it changes, it's like, your whole prospect is like, okay.
Right.
This is really bad.
Right. And especially as a kid, is being like, "Oh, well, I thought if that kind of thing was going to happen, someone would have stopped it. I thought we had a thing in place that would make sure this never happened to us." And I say us, meaning like the version of modern America in 2001. I thought we had safeguards for this kind of thing.
Right.
And the fact that we don't, and there was so much confusion around, was like, "Oh, okay. Things can still go wrong," which is, again, like the privilege of being a naive suburban white kid.
Well, yeah, that's what I remember being in history class in high school and thinking the same thing as you, is like, history was something that already happened. And like, now we all get to learn about it, and the generations ahead of us will just keep using these textbooks forever. And you think, like, you'd hear about wars and you'd be like, "Oh, people had it really wrong then. Thank God we're so much better now." And like, all that's over. There'll never be another world war or anything like that. You don't realize that history's continuing, and we're all just as shitty as we always were.
And there was also that same kind of, it feels so shitty to say, that same kind of temptation that you touched on earlier, where it was like, "Man, it'd be cool if we had another Lincoln or something. Like, it'd be cool if we had another, like, thing that would make it into the history books, but I don't think anything else is going to happen. I don't think anything interesting is going to happen for the rest of my life." And then suddenly something interesting does happen, and you wish it didn't.
Right.
And that's my opening salvo into this comedy advice podcast that we do. Jesus, I'm so sorry.
Oh, well, Dan, I have a question for you that's also about when you were younger, and this is college age. I got a quick question.
Okay. Is it about 9/11? Because, no, it's college age. So yeah. Is it about Hurricane Katrina?
This one is Sandy.
Okay. Hulk. Oh, that's after. Oh God.
Good. I'm glad you caught the rest of it. Oh, I thought it got buried. No, this is different. This is a little more lighthearted. I wanted to ask you if there was something that you, in college, you thought, "I have to prepare, I have to do this because the rest of the world cares so much about this outside of college." And then you found out the world didn't care at all and would never ask about it again. And I realize that's mealy mouth. So let me give you an example. I was trying to get honors in English, and comparative literature. I thought honors was like, you graduate with honors, and that's a huge huge way to distinguish yourself when you put it on a resume. When anybody in the world outside of school sees that, they're gonna be like, oh my goodness, this boy graduated with honors. Well, bring him right in. Bring him in.
You assume honors exists in the system because it will matter at some point.
Yeah, and it's hard. Writing an honors thesis, I mean, I don't know what honors is like for every single field of study, but for literature, you're writing an honors thesis. And it's big. It's a monumental task. It's going to take you most of the year to do. It's on top of your regular work. And at the end, you have to defend it. You present it and you have to defend it against people who will, teachers who will try and poke holes in it. It's like an arduous process.
Yeah.
And I was doing it. I was going through it. I was writing it. And at a certain point, I gave up on it. And I felt like such a failure. And I thought, this is going to be such a blemish for me the rest of my life. And it has not fucking mattered one bit. The world does not give a shit about honors. Like, yeah. There's no job out there that's hiring somebody who did their honors thesis on Alcibiades in ancient Greece in the real world who's like, oh, yeah. Tell me more about your honors project. It will never help you at all.
I mean, it'll help you. I mean, like, this is the bullshit response to that it'll help you in that, like, the things you have learned in the pursuit of that thesis have informed who you are today, I assume, right?
Yeah.
No,
yeah, that's true.
But no, I recognize that as bullshit. I felt that way about two things. One of them was GPA, which became so important to me in college.
Yeah.
Just as like a gratification renewing machine. When my first semester, I left with a 4.0, or my first year left with a 4.0 GPA and was like, oh, this feels good. Now I need this forever. And then maintained that until my senior year, when I had a professor who just wanted to teach me a lesson by not giving me an A in his class. And it was the one class I didn't get an A in. And I was very upset and it kept me from getting a 4.0. And I like met with him privately to argue with him because I was one of those pieces of shit. And I was like, I need this thing. And he was like, you don't. And in fact, you'll learn a lesson if you don't get it. And like, he's wrong, but also right. Like, he's wrong in that I didn't learn a lesson from him, but he's right in that no one gave a fucking shit about what my GPA was. My first job out of college at Cracked, they didn't even check to make sure that I had a college diploma, right, let alone what my GPA was. And then since then, whether I was freelancing or consulting or now at Last Week Tonight, no one has asked for my transcripts or what my GPA was or what my SAT scores were.
And yeah.
None of those things matter. And like a thing that I was so like driven to fight for, because like A, I thought I deserved this grade, and B, I thought this was going to be the difference maker, man. If I can leave this school with a 4.0, then like all the doors are going to be open, and I can't conceive of a single door that would be open to me now that is not open to me if I did have a 4.0 GPA right now.
I think it only matters
if I had like a 2.0 GPA right now.
Right. I think it only matters if you're going to continue with school. If you're like, now I'm going to get my master's, like then it, yes, maybe I could see it mattering. But in the greater scheme of things, like outside of scholastics in the world, you're like, I feel so foolish for having spent so much time worrying about my grades. And yeah. I didn't even totally do it for me either. I was doing it thinking the world will care at some point. And I was thinking, well, my parents would be really disappointed if I got a C or like something, yes, like that. And then you realize afterwards, like, wow, I was doing that for my parents. They wouldn't have cared. Like,
right.
But it's, yeah, that was one that really, I hit home for me really recently where I was like, oh yeah, fucking honors. Yeah. Nobody gives a shit about that. People are going to say, you know, well, you have to get the self-satisfaction of having completed it. You learn the tools in your arsenal you build by having to defend your honors thesis are all really valuable. Man, I got all those other places. I didn't need it.
Yeah.
It's overlap.
I remember this isn't like too recently, but a couple of years ago, someone talking about the different, like Latin phrases that they associate with different levels of honors in graduation of college.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where someone was like, oh yeah, magna cum laude. That's the highest. And I was like, no, it's summa cum laude.
Yeah.
And in my head, I'm thinking, because that's what I got. And they're like, no, I'm pretty sure it's magna. And then the conversation continued. And I'm just like sitting there quietly stewing, like, oh, none of it mattered. They don't even remember which one is higher. Why did I do any of this?
Were you Phi Beta Kappa?
No.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't either. My wife was. And at the time, it seemed like, this is it, man. This is the golden ticket to like a career. It just became like this huge hassle where you have to meet with the other Phi Beta Kappas every once in a while. And like, you don't know any of them. You don't like them.
Does her work continue with Phi Beta Kappa?
No.
Okay. She doesn't. She's out now.
I think, yeah. Well, it's blood in, blood out. So I think she got chain whipped and then she was done.
The only other thing I'm thinking of from college that I thought was going to be important was, it's only because it was revolutionary to me at the time, was studying English and comparative literature and getting into close reading, which is a literary pursuit that I think anyone should check out. It's just studying books and poetry in a way that is not just like, it's not just evaluating on a critical level. You're looking at form and content and how they inform each other. And it was eye-opening and fascinating to me, as much as it was like the first time you read in middle school or high school Animal Farm. And it's the first time you realize, oh, it's not just about animals.
Right.
It's about a whole thing. That's how I felt studying close reading, where it's like, oh, the poem, it's not just that it rhymes. It's also that like the way that it rhymes also tells like an additional part of the story. You can use every part of the animal to tell the same story and sometimes contradict the story if you want to. It was very exciting to me to have like my eyes open. It's like, again, Animal Farm. It's like learning about metaphor for the first time. Learning about close reading was like, okay, this is a new way of thinking about everything in the world. And I thought, I'm going to leave college and I'm going to apply close reading to fucking restaurant menus. I'm going to apply it to reality shows. I'm going to throw it everywhere and everyone's going to think this is a superpower that I have. And it just wasn't.
I mean, it's like a monkey paw curse for you, honestly. You did have to end up using it, but now you can't turn it off.
No.
That we got very lucky with Cracked in that this one thing that we were very good at out of college, we got to continue doing and no one else did.
Right. I spent a bunch of college learning how to talk about Shakespeare and Dylan Thomas. And then I immediately turned around and I was like, what if I applied that to Saved by the Bell?
Right.
What if I did that same thing?
Yeah, exactly. Where I had a teacher who was like, it was so eye-opening for me that we were reading, I can't remember what it was. Maybe it was like the Odyssey or whatever, but he was like, look, there's going to be a lot of things in here that you can look at and you can say, you can just disregard it because you think, oh, it was people a long time ago. They didn't know any better. But like the way that they treat women in that book, for instance, or the way that what's important to him is like making sure that he kills all of his wife's suitors, like that stuff that seems very savage and archaic to us now. And he's like, you're going to want to do that. Don't do that. If there is something weird in there in the story, think about why it's there and how it serves the story in a timeless way. And yeah. I was like, fuck yeah. And so then that like informed exactly how I treated all shows that way. Anything that was weird or there was like some element of a movie that was like, oh, that's a strange moment, I would sit there and just think about it. I was like, well, why is it there? How does it make it better? Like,
yeah.
And in a lot of ways that was great for Cracked and completely dangerous and bad for you in the rest of your life.
Oh yeah. So it's here's a perfect mind shattering example for me is that so much of close reading in college was looking at things that seem strange and asking yourself, well, what if it's on purpose? What if this thing that feels incongruous is on purpose? And then applying that to so many things. And then I had like an opportunity of a lifetime on the old Cracked podcast with, at the time, Jack and Michael Swaim. We guested with two great Simpsons writers after a Simpsons After Hours episode that we did. And I had like, at that point, 15 years of Simpsons fan theories that were all based on the presumption that there were no accidents and everything was on purpose. And we just had this golden opportunity to go to Mike Rice and Jeff Martin and be like, so in this one episode at the flea market in Homer's Barbershop Quartet, Skinner grabs a helmet with the prisoner code 24601. And several seasons later, we learned that he lived a dual identity. And 24601 is the number of Jean Valjean in Les Mis, who also lived a dual identity. So did you plant this 5 years before the Principal and the Pauper episode where we found out about Skinner's backstory? And they were just like, no. We just thought it was funny to say 24601. Like, this guy likes musicals. Jeff Martin really loves musical theater, so he dropped that number in there. And then we forgot about it later. And, like, that was the entire episode, was Michael and I, like, firing off these close reading fan theories. And they're just like, no, I mean, that's interesting, but no.
I can just see the two of you in comic book nerds t-shirt. Like, this,
yes,
one arm,
absolutely.
Your arm coming out of one side, Michael's out of the other.
Yeah.
This is a two-headed monster.
The yeah. shirt is too tight for us, so it's like over our bellies, you know?
Yeah, it's so useless sometimes. And you catch yourself doing it at train stops and things like that, where they're like, you'll see a misspelling and you're like, why would they have done that? And then you start like getting, so there's a story about a guy who tried to create a universal language, and I'm going to butcher this. It would be great if I could have researched this beforehand, but to brush up on it, but there's a guy who tried to create a universal language that would be for everyone. And one of the things that he wanted to have happen is that every note also represented a letter of this alphabet that he had. I think it was only like 12 letters long. And then every color represented a different letter. So you could not only communicate, you could not only do sentences in words, you could do them with a song, like the lyrics would be written into the notes of the song. You could do it with a painting. You could have basically a story within the painting just by coloring. And he taught it to a few people. He had some students that learned it, and they quickly kind of went crazy because they kept trying to apply it to the world. Everywhere they looked, there was clearly this information coming at them that they couldn't help but try to decipher, and none of it was intentional. And like, that just drives you nuts for the rest of your life.
Do you know when this happened?
No.
Okay. That's fine. I mean, you, this is, as our audience knows, a thoroughly prepared podcast. So you have no excuse for not having this information at the ready.
Yeah.
Did he raise people in isolation?
No. These were grad students, I think, that he taught it to. And then they continued to, like, they all got fluent in it. And eventually it just drove them nuts.
That's so fascinating, because I know you also told me that story about the scientist or literary professor who experimented on his own child with certain colors.
Yeah, so it sounds way worse than it is, but it is pretty fucked up what he did. He didn't teach his daughter the name for the color blue.
Yeah.
He taught her all the other color names, but just left out blue. And so when she got to a certain age, she didn't have that. And because she didn't have that in her vocabulary, the color didn't exist to her. Like, when you'd ask her what color the sky was, she would say white. And so without having the word as the connecting piece between the thought and the thing, then you don't have the thing and the thought can't ever meet.
Right. I'm taking the wrong takeaway from this, which is, I wonder if you raised an entire like colony of babies on this 12 word, 12 color, 12 tone, universal communicative style, what that would do. Cause I feel like 12 tones, sure, they're set, but there are more than 12 colors. There are different shades, and there are certainly more than 12 words.
Yeah. The way that it broke down in the language, I'm pretty sure, was the words just became really long because you had such a small alphabet. To distinguish each word, some words were like 15 to like 20 letters long, and those were common words. but I don't know. It makes me think of exactly what you did. You learned these lessons in college. You're like, ah, these are tools I'll use the rest of my life. And then every time you tried to use them, they just made you crazier.
Yes. Folks, we love doing this show. And if you want us to keep doing it, there are a couple of ways you can support us. One is you can get your friends to download and subscribe. And another is you can show some love to our amazing sponsors. And this week we are talking about Skillshare. Skillshare is an online learning community with thousands of inspiring classes for creative and curious people. Explore new skills, deepen existing passions, and get lost in creativity. There are a lot of topics that would appeal to our audience, things that you need in these times, whether you need to be creative. There are productivity classes. There are lifestyle classes. There are, if this is the time that you wanted to learn how to be an entrepreneur, you can take classes with Skillshare. There's no better time than right now to do that. You can learn about web development, marketing, animation, whatever you want. Skillshare has it. Skillshare offers creative classes designed for real life and all the circumstances that come with it. Break up the routine of a day spent indoors. Explore workshops, classes, and more in topics like productivity, freelance, and entrepreneurship. A creative challenge or productivity class may help in setting small goals and feeling fulfillment and sense of accomplishment. Soren, I've been having fun with a Skillshare class that I started taking. It's filmmaking from home, turn found footage into compelling video by a creator named Penny Lane. She is my instructor. She is a filmmaker. And I've sort of exhausted making puzzles and teaching myself close hand magic here in my apartment. And so now I've been having a whole lot of fun using a creative outlet that is very new to me, which is editing footage and trying to tell stories with edited footage. And this class has been great for that. It's been telling me all about like the safe ways to find found footage and then how to turn it into a compelling video. And I really like it a whole lot. That's just one thing that I'm doing, but there are a number of Skillshare classes that you can all take. I suggest doing this one because it's something that's great that you could do from your home, which is perfect for quarantine.
I want to see those so badly.
Oh, they're going to be great. We'll put them, Bacon's going to put them in the footnotes and it's going to be awesome. Whatever you want to do, you can explore your creativity and get 2 free months of premium membership at skillshare.com/QQ. That's 2 whole months of unlimited access to thousands of classes for free. Get started and join today by heading to skillshare.com/QQ. That's 2 free months of unlimited access to thousands of classes at skillshare.com/QQ. Soren, I got a quick question for you.
Okay.
It's going to sound weird. I need you to help me come up with a phrase to describe a specific type of problem. I'd been previously calling it, well, you know it for a while as a Michael Swain problem. I've been with people who aren't you. I've been calling it a dad problem, but that sounds unfair because it's not specific to my dad or you as a dad or all dads. It's a problem, generally a tech problem that you either can't explain or replicate to a tech support person. And like I've been pretty tech savvy most of my life. I know a lot of the terminology. But I recently had my first blank problem, because I don't know what to call it anymore, where with my TV. And I was too embarrassed to call the cable company because the only thing I'd be able to say was, my cable is different now. Can you help me? Because normally I know, like I can call them and be like, oh yeah, the router's out. I tried resetting it. I think you need to do something on your end, and they would ping it on their end, and then they would try something else on their end. And like, I could like, it was a conversation that could flow easily. But this is the time that I have a Vizio TV with SmartCast, and I also have Vios, and I like split between SmartCast and my Fios provider for like the different multiple things that I subscribe to.
Okay.
HBO Max, for example, and Hulu and whatnot and all those things. And one day in my input, when I pressed my input button on the remote, the thing that used to connect to my Fios box wasn't there anymore. And I didn't know what to say to anyone.
It was like your HDMI 1 wasn't there?
Yes.
Okay.
Like normally there's a series of letters instead of HDMI 1. And then one day there wasn't. and I checked the plugs and they were all plugged in, and I unplugged things and replugged things and reset things. And luckily, like, I mean, the end of this story is that I just, like a true Irish Catholic, sat with things being wrong. And then one day they got better. And
it fixed itself?
Yeah.
Oh, Jesus. That's a terrible lesson for you to learn.
I know. I wanted to call Fios and be like, listen, here's my problem. But I didn't know, like technology has gone beyond me at that point. And as I get older, I know that's going to be more and more of a problem. So I wanted to figure out if you could help me, like, what the best, how do we categorize that kind of problem?
Yeah. So it's also like,
it's tech that is beyond you.
Tech that's beyond you, but also like you don't even know necessarily which tech is the problem.
Yes.
You're embarrassed to ask, because if you ask the wrong people, they're like, that's not even, what the fuck? That's, you're talking about your TV inputs. Why are you calling your modem company?
Right. I didn't want to call fucking Time Warner Cable and be like, my internet's working, but I can't find HBO anymore.
You should explain also why that's called, just within our circle, a Michael Swain problem.
Because Michael Swain, as we all know, is a gifted genius. But for as long as I've known him, he has had computer problems that can neither be replicated nor explained. And like, this is dating back to when we worked in a new media tech startup internet company in 2008.
Yes.
Where we're just surrounded by people who know how to solve computer problems and people who have grown up on computers. And he was just like, my MacBook is doing this now.
Right. So it was always something so weird. Like he would, every time he sent an email, it would eat a Microsoft Word document off his computer, yeah, or right, like stuff that doesn't exist for anyone else in the world. And at first you're like, wow, that computer's fucked up. And then you start to realize it's just him. There's this orbit around him of chaos that like technological chaos that somehow he has just been burdened with. And you don't know, you can't solve it for him. There's not going to be anybody out there who can. And he's sort of resigned to it. He doesn't care.
Right. We're like, Michael, why didn't you go to this meeting today? I sent you an invite. And he's like, oh yeah, sometimes invites go to Spain. Like, what the, how? What do you, no, they don't. They can't. And then I look at his computer and sure enough, they do. And I'm like, well, all right. I don't know what to say.
At that tech company we worked at, they used to say that in those circumstances, the problem, they could isolate the problem to between the chair and the keyboard, which I always was like, oh, that's clever of you nerds. And because usually they're talking about me.
Right.
But I don't, yeah, see, I don't know.
And then you were always like, where did you come up with that? Did you come up with that when you were sitting home during prom, you fucking losers? I remember you said that like two or three times a week.
I'd say it all the time. And I didn't even have a prom. we need a name for this.
Yeah. Like dad problem immediately came to me because I think one of the early non-Michael Swain times this came to my attention was from my dad, who is great and an incredible person, but would just text me, be like, hey, Hotmail is different now. And I'd be like, well, I haven't used Hotmail in 15 years, so I don't know what it used to be. And I don't know how to get it to where you want it to go again. So I don't know how to help you with this problem. But I recognize that dad problem is like, you're a dad and my brother David is a dad. And it's not like a universally dad experience to screw up in tech. Case in point, me at this moment.
Yeah. But it does seem like it hits dads pretty hard. I guess there's just dads of a certain generation.
We can put it to, like, we can have our audience come up with, they can tweet at our producer, Make Me Bacon, Please, and give him some suggestions for us to name this thing, because I do think we can have a recurring segment of quote unquote dad problems that we have. In the meantime, do you have any dad problems that you can think of personally?
Yeah, I had one. You talking about your TV reminded me that when I had my son, I was trying to figure out a way that I could watch my television with cordless headphones. I just wanted like some Bluetooth headphones that I could plug in. Mm-hmm. And everywhere I went, I was trying to explain that to people. And they're like, no, you can't do that. And I was like, no, that can't be right. Surely I can. And
the TV is nice and the headphones are nice and I have money.
Yeah. How is this a problem? And I quickly learned that the type of television that I had didn't have an output on it. There's no like jack. And because there was no jack, it made it very, very difficult to solve this problem. And then it became a situation where I couldn't even describe what I needed anymore, because what I needed to do ultimately was there wasn't an audio out for the TV that was like I can't remember what they're called. It's like, if you open it up, there's like a little red light that comes out, optical out or something like that. And I needed to hook that up into a adapter for RCA cables. Those cables then went to a Bluetooth output.
Yeah.
And then that output I had to pair with my headphones. And then I had to manipulate this like weird stuff within the television to make sure in like the firmware, like make sure that this would actually work. And it was like a month long project where I was on the phone with LG and I was like, just tell me, there's somebody has to have done this with your television in the past. And they were like, no, can't be done.
Man. That's the kind of thing that like, first I would say, hey, I want Bluetooth wireless headphones for my TV. And if they started giving me that list of instructions, I'd be like, no. It should be easier than that. Yeah. I don't know why. I don't know how, but it should be easier. So like, give me the easier version, please.
They
give
were
me
like,
the version where I don't need to get three different objects.
Right. And they were like, well, you could do it with a Roku. And I'm like, I don't have a Roku. Well, you could do it with a PS. If you just take your PlayStation 4 controller and you just plug your headphones in that. And I was like, no. I don't have any of those things. I know that a TV has Bluetooth capability. I can go to a little place and it says Bluetooth and like, yeah, but that's not really for this.
Right. I just want to like, listen to me. I have a nice TV, an Apple TV, a 3.85 GPA. So I should be able to listen to whatever I want, wherever I want, forever.
I finished 3/4 of my honors thesis. You will help me. There's like a, I don't know what to call it, but it's like a technological like wasteland for it, but it follows you. It's like a cloud, technological chaos cloud.
Yeah, I don't love it. I don't love, I mean, like it could be summed up as I'm getting older, but it's I'm lulled into a false sense of security because for 2 years I've had this TV and this cable set up and it has worked. And that made me think that I was tech savvy. And then suddenly one thing goes wrong and I checked the plugs and I was like, oh no.
Right.
I'm out of moves.
I love those moments where you just don't even know where to turn. Cause I will sheepishly call the first company. I'm like, well, let's see, let's start with the television and see, mm-hmm. or like, let's start with the cables themselves. Well, oh, here's a name. All right. And then I will get on the phone. I'm like, okay, so
right.
Here's the deal.
It's especially tough because like Verizon Fios makes it like incredibly difficult to get to a human being, which is the death knell for people like me who are at this stage in life. You can't call anyone. You have to go to the website and they're like, describe your problem based on this drop down menu. And I'm like, no, man. Because one of the options in the drop-down menu isn't things are different. And that's the only thing I have for you.
that like technological helplessness. I had a moment recently of like, that wasn't technologically based, but it was this absolute helplessness. And it was about something very, very serious. I got a check from the IRS, this like big, big check from the IRS. For no reason, mm-hmm. because I owed money this year. And I was like, what is this? And I can't just have it sitting around. So I cash it. And then I start trying to call the IRS to figure out what's going on.
Why can't you have it sitting around?
I don't feel weird about having big sums of money on just a one piece of paper in my
house.
Did
you think your son was going to rob you?
Well, I'll lose it. It's more me. I'm the problem. And so I cashed it. And then I was like, what is this? So I kept trying to get in touch with the IRS. And because of COVID and everything, they are famously impossible to get in touch with.
Yes.
They send all their, anyone who you could talk to on a phone is all sent home, and they don't work the banks anymore. You can't even leave a message. They give you this intermediary that you can go through. And so I sent them a message in there. They have a form you can fill out on their website with a certain number of characters and try to say it as best as I could in the short amount of time. And then maybe like 3 months later, got a call from them. And it was very sketchy because the call was coming from, you know, like when a spammer is trying to get a hold of you, that they're like, this number's from New York.
Yeah. Potential scam likely.
Yeah.
Navajo, New York. Yeah.
Got that. And the guy was like, I could hear his TV on in the background and stuff. And I was like, this is bogus. And so I hung up, and then a woman called me back, and she knew all this information about me. And she was like, we know that you submitted this. Here's exactly what you wrote. And so she was trying to help me. She had never heard of this either. And she's like, you're going to have to contact the IRS. And I was like, I don't know how.
And could you patch me through?
And ultimately, like, she looked into it. And I'm eternally grateful to her because she has the language. Like, the arsenal of words is there for her. Whereas, like, this glossary doesn't exist for me. So I'm just fumbling trying to explain it to her like a horse trying to stamp it out in the dirt.
Right.
And she came back to me and she was like, oh, okay, here's what happened. Apparently it's going to happen with a few other people. For some reason, they have filed your, the amount that you owed and you sent in the money for, they applied it to 2018. Then they saw later that 2018 had already been paid for. So they sent your money back plus the interest for how long they'd kept the check. And I was like, oh, okay, great. And they're like, but that means that you haven't paid for your taxes this year. And so there might be a penalty. And I was like, oh, okay, got it. And kind of figured it out that way. And because I had brought it to their attention, they're like, we've now seen that other people are suffering from this as well. And so they had solved it through all this process. And because I had flagged it, like, other people got it solved as well. And when I say solved, whatever money the IRS sent them, they stole back.
I'm very curious because, like, over the last, like, 4 years now, not the last, probably, like, certainly not last year, but the last 4 years or so have gotten random checks from Los Angeles. And they've made me, like, they've never been big checks, but they've made me nervous because I think anything could be a scam because I'm stupid. And so I've always called whatever number I could call. And I was like, hey, you guys sent me $12.16 in February. And I'm afraid to sign it because I'm dumb. And they're like, oh, yeah, no, the thing is, in 2016, we screwed up your taxes. And we're just catching up to that now. So here's an extra $12 for you that we forgot about. And that has happened 3 or 4 times, specifically from Los Angeles.
Wow. That's crazy that they're being that honest about it.
Yeah.
Well, that makes me feel actually a little better about my taxes. I would just assume that if they ever saw that sort of thing, they'd just be like, well, he doesn't know any better.
Yeah.
We've tracked the things that he's spending money on. This is not a guy that knows any better.
Right. Give it a month. If he calls, we'll give it back to him. If not, fucking whatever.
Yeah. That's how Comcast would treat it.
Money's like, not real.
Well, yeah. So it ended up being a very scary thing where I thought, and then I was like looking up scams on how people do that. And there is a scam associated with it, but it wasn't that.
Yeah. Do you have any more questions for me, or are we're pretty close to wrapping up, I think.
Let's see what else. Oh yeah, we're right on it.
Yeah. I'm going to track down all the social accounts, and normally this is a time where we use this space to challenge the other person to either embarrass or fail to exonerate themselves in some way. But because everything is so sad and terrible right now, that I figured I would just use this space to surprise Soren and say, hey, Soren, what's something sweet you'd like to say about your wife?
That's nice of you, Dan.
Shouldn't take you this long to think about it at all.
I want to find like the best thing to say about her. So she is a mother again to an infant, and I had forgotten how great she is as a mom to a really small baby. She's so good with her, and like when they're this young, they're just kind of like in a larval state. They don't give you anything back. And it doesn't matter. There's just like this profound amount of love coming out of her that this baby just absorbs and offers nothing in return other than like explosive diarrhea. And she's so good with her and so patient with our son at the same time that there are times where I'm watching them and I'm thinking, if I died in a car crash, she'd be fine.
Oh, damn. That's so sweet. I mean, like, super sad at the end, but very sweet. Excellently, excellently done. You can find Soren on Twitter and tell him what a good husband and dad he is at Soren_LTD. You could find me at DLB_INC. You could find the founder of this podcast at Make Me Bacon Please, spelled PLS. And you can tweet at him, whatever it is I told you to tweet at him earlier. You can find the show on Twitter at QQ_SorenandDan. You can email us at qqwithsorenanddaniel@gmail.com. We're still soliciting audience advice if we should have guests on the show or not, and what kind of guests you'd like us to have and what you'd like us to talk about. You can hire our producer, engineer, editor, guru, Gabe at gabeharder.com. I'm reluctant to check. What am I going to find if I go to gabeharder.com right now, Gabe?
You're going to find nothing. You're going to not find a website. It's not there. It's never going to be there, probably. Yeah.
If there was nothing there, that would be new.
It got taken down. I built this whole website, and then it just stopped working for some reason. But I did the whole thing. It was really great. It was beautiful. It had contact information. But it's just the whole thing's gone now, and it's hard to find the motivation to start it all over.
I understand that. That's very fine. Yeah. You can also support the show on Patreon. As we've mentioned, you can also support the show by telling your friends to download and subscribe, or by supporting any of our magnificent sponsors. But I believe that's it. Yeah, Soren, do you have no, go ahead.
Gabe makes me feel like that turtle in the Neverending Story. Do you remember that giant tortoise that had the cold and kept sneezing on a tray?
We don't even care whether or not we care.
Yeah, that one. And it says, like, when Trey's trying to warn that the nothing's coming, and the turtle's just like, good. At least the nothing would be something. That's how I feel about Gabe's website.
You've made a real turn on Gabe this week.
Yeah, fuck you, Gabe.
All right.
Bye.
Bye.